Ja, das ist gut.
Guten Abend, guten Abend, guten Abend.
I know that if everything goes well, I'd like to use this or parts of it.
Sure.
For this book.
Sure.
But you'll get a copy of that first, and you can read that and edit or whatever.
I can make sure it don't sound like a real dunce.
Okay. All right. There's no specific line of questions that I have, but you've lived in Canada for several years now?
10 years.
And, right.
I should set the date up. June 2nd, 1990. Where are we? We're in Regina, right?
That's right. Oh, I was going to add that onto that.
Oh, I always add okay. that. What is it? Renaissance something or other?
Ramada
Renaissance. We eat Saskatoon berry pie. Just the two of us.
And,
all right.
And some watered down coffee.
And
some
watered,
tea.
That's right, very watered down coffee. Yeah, 10 years I've been at Lethbridge.
And I guess that the reception of your book, since it was, I mean, the novel was published here, probably people will be labeling you under Canadian native author. How do you see that?
Yeah,
is
well,
there a problem there, or what kind of problem would that be?
Well, there's only a problem in the sense that I'm not originally from Canada, and the Cherokee certainly aren't a Canadian tribe. Now, that becomes a problem only if you recognize that particular political line that runs between Canada and the U.S. And I have trouble with the assumptions that line makes, but I think of myself as a native writer and a Canadian writer.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that I could call myself a Canadian native writer,
okay.
Just because I'm not from one of the tribes up here. But all of my short stories and the novel and the anthologies and the critical book that I co-edited,
mm-hmm.
were published here in Canada, and they all have to do with Canadian material. I've done nothing in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
to speak of, and so yeah, I consider myself a Canadian writer. I mean, you know, I write about the Canadian prairies.
Okay.
I don't write about
yeah.
Montana, so
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sort of stuck out in the cold a little bit, but it's okay. It's okay.
Do you find that definitions like that are necessary or helpful, and how would you define native literature?
Yeah, they're not helpful. They're not helpful to me particularly, but I don't mind them. When someone says, "Are you a native writer?" I take it as a description of me and who I am and not my work particularly. So what they're saying is, you're a native who writes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's perfectly good description for me.
Mm-hmm.
If they ask me, are you a native writer, and what they mean is, are you a writer who happens to be native and only writes about native things, then
mm-hmm.
it's a poor description, because
yeah.
I don't. I write about non-native material too.
So would you then sort of try to define native writing as something dealing with native people?
Nope.
Or
nope.
using certain metaphors? Or
nope.
Do you think one should do that?
But my best definition for native literature is that native literature is literature produced by native people.
Okay. Yeah, same here.
Yeah, and that's as far as I'm willing to go, because as soon as you start to talk about what's in the literature itself,
mm-hmm.
you run into all sorts of trouble. As soon as you start mm-hmm. to try to describe who is an Indian and who is not, oh, it's a mess.
Yeah, I mean, even the definition native literature is literature written by a native, you end up with this mess of definitions. But at least
yeah.
you could say that author is established or can be established that she or he is native.
Yeah, they're recognized by a community or, you know,
yeah, okay.
but see, you can say native literature is literature produced by native people as long as you don't ask who is a native, because that opens the whole can of worms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pretty nasty can of worms too. I mean, back in the 60s and the 70s, there were, in essence, sort of litmus tests for who was a good Indian or who wasn't
mm-hmm.
a good Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, that becomes a concern. In some ways, I think it's people feeling, I don't know what the word is. I don't know how to explain it. I better not try to explain it. Maybe I'll come back to it.
I think it shows that really drawing these borderlines is sometimes perhaps necessary, but really it creates more problems than it solves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got you've got extreme cases where you have someone like, let's say, Jamaki Highwater.
Sure.
Okay. Who, so far as I guess we've been able to figure out, is not native.
That's
is,
right.
Doesn't have native ancestry. And the complaint about Highwater was that he was using native identity to sell his books and make a lot of money now, and to get himself some notoriety. That might be true. At the same time, Highwater is going to produce two of the very best books on native art. Now, they'll be superseded, no doubt. But at the time, his second book in particular is going to give young native artists a real boost, because he's going to highlight many of those artists that no one had seen before, at least in print. And, you know, provides a very valuable service to that whole field of native art. But it is important, I think, to keep those kinds of lines straight, because otherwise we begin to have non-natives doing the same thing they've done for years and years, and that's to speak for native people. And I should say, that isn't a role I'm even interested in being involved in. There are enough people from the various tribes, you know, who are speak both languages, you know, who have very close ties, which I don't, to their tribe, who are going to do that for each one of the tribes. Everybody tries to hit upon one particular Indian at any point in time to answer all the questions about Indian affairs for all of North America. And if they haven't got an Indian person they can do that with, and they pick up another kind of social guru, like, well, Carlos Castaneda was that for a while. Lynn Andrews seems to be it now, and I really do get fairly appalled when that begins to happen. I don't care if the person's native or non-native. To put anybody into a role like that, particularly a non-native who knows squat about natives, is maddening.
Yeah.
Just maddening.
If you think of native writing in Canada and native writing in the U.S., do you see, is there just a time lag between the developments, or are the developments independent? How do you see, if you compare them in a sort of overall view?
I think what happens with between the U.S. and Canada is that in the U.S. you have that cornerstone in Scott Momaday's House Man of Dawn. It comes out in 69 when, so far as we can see, there's very little on the landscape. It comes just bang like that. It wins the Pulitzer Prize. It becomes a marker for all the rest of us. I mean, all of us read it. And then right on its heels, you come out with Welsh's Winter in the Blood and Silko's Ceremony. Well, those three become sort of a triumvirate. And in the space of from 69 to 76 is when those are published. And they're good novels. You know, fairly strong novels, not a weak novel among them. And so there's a great send-off for contemporary native literature in the U.S. Now, in Canada, that really hasn't happened. The closest thing that we have to it, I think, is Thompson Highway's plays. And they sort of serve the same function, and probably would have served the function even more had Thompson won the Governor General's Award at either one of those 2 years. But he does win the Dora Maver Moore Award. Or Dora?
I think that points to a sort of different kind of development. The way I see it is sort of the inroad of native literature in general has been made by Momaday, as you said. But there's very little in drama in the U.S. And here Canada, there seems to be a very surprising amount of drama.
Yeah, that is the interesting thing.
Is there an explanation for that?
I don't know.
I
would have thought that drama would come first. I mean, looking at oral literature, looking at more traditional forms of entertainment and ceremonial, I would have suspected that drama would come first. And I don't know why it didn't in the U.S., but it certainly didn't. I mean, the major playwright, native playwright in the U.S., so far as I know, is Hanne Gigema. And he brought out that collection of three plays early on and has been very active in native theater. And I know there are other native playwrights, certainly, but they don't get much exposure. I mean, exposure on the common market, the general market. But in Canada, for some reason, I think maybe it's the fact that Highway is a playwright, and those plays got a lot of attention when they came out. And of course, you have a very strong native playwriting community in Ontario. Mm-hmm. And you also have a bit of one in Saskatoon and out in Vancouver.
Even in Regina.
In Regina, yeah. It's an odd thing, because when I was doing a bibliography on Native literature, contemporary Native literature, and as I was going through that, when I call people up and say, who's writing, you know, so I can get their names in there, more people knew dramatists than anybody else. Mm-hmm. And I was able to call, what's the outfit in Ontario that Elaine Bomberry used to be executive director of? Native Earth Performing Arts.
Mm-hmm.
Elaine was able to just go down a whole list of people who were playwrights, whose plays have been workshopped, whose plays have been performed. And even someone like George Kinney, who produces Indians Don't Cry early on, is also going to write a play early on, too, called October Stranger. And that's performed. So, yeah, there is. I don't know why that is. I don't know why that is. But there seems to be more emphasis on drama immediately in Canada at sort of what you'd call the beginning. But these beginnings are very nebulous kinds of things, because all the beginnings do is sort of provide you with a flashlight to look back a few years, and you can see that other people are doing things also. But you're quite right. Drama seems to be the novel in the States is the way in which contemporary Native writers get a boost. Drama here in Canada seems to be the way in which it's going to work. But of course now you've got people like Ruby Slipperjack, who's a wonderful novelist, really wonderful, first rate.
Yeah.
I think people really don't realize how good she is, and I suspect that Slipperjack doesn't know how good she is
either. She doesn't.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
Yeah, the more I read that book, the more I'm impressed with what she's able to do and accomplish. Yeah. Very, very skilled.
She told me that she's writing on something, thinking about something that is set in the contemporary world, in an urban setting. But she said that then some people will recognize themselves in it and maybe get hurt. So she said, I won't write it or I won't get it published. And even this book had been sitting on a shelf for years and years, and she never thought about publishing it. And then somebody picked it up and said, listen, we're going to publish this. You've got yourself a novel.
Yeah.
She was really a closet writer.
Well, she's... you never know. That's the thing. You never know where these people are going to come at you from. Because there's quite a few small presses. Mm-hmm. There's Fifth House and Pemmican and Thetis and many other presses that will publish Native work. And you just don't know until it just sort of pops up. And hers was a great surprise and a wonderful treat.
Yes, true. So,
but there's Robinson, too. And there's even, you know, Basil Johnston... whose book just came out with Key Porter, Indian School Days.
Oh, yeah.
They sold that as an autobiography. And I'll never be able to call it autobiography. Basil sent me one of the stories that's in the autobiography as a piece of fiction for this anthology, the Canadian Fiction Magazine anthology. And I think of it as a piece of fiction. It may have all sorts of autobiographical elements in it, but that's a fine piece of writing.
Yeah.
Really is quite skilled.
You mean Indian School Days?
Indian School Days, yeah.
And more so than...
More so than Moose Meat and Wild Rice, yeah.
That's catering to a very large market.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Indian School Days, one of the things I like about Indian School Days and Honor the Sun is that both of those books deal with Native community. They don't involve themselves to any great extent with the clash between Native and non-Native cultures. They concentrate on the Native kids in the boarding school, or Slipperjack concentrates on that family up in Northern Ontario. And I think by avoiding that clash and getting caught up in the debate of which culture is better, which many writers are tempted by, and it's a deadly thing to get into, I think, really deadly.
This is Ruby Farrell said, she didn't want to get involved in all the politics.
Yeah.
A lot of native writers are into it. And she said, I'm not political, I'm not interested in that. And I think this is what she was expressing.
Well, I think once you get involved in whose culture is better, and in the politics of native, non-native relationships, I think you get suckered in to beginning to look at the world through non-native eyes. I think you run the risk of having to redefine yourself, having to justify yourself as a native and as a native writer. Johnston and Slipperjack both avoid that completely. They simply say, here is the world that I want to describe, and it's a world that I know. I mean, for instance, Johnston has all sorts of opportunities to just blast the Jesuits at the school there. And yet in the end, you come away with as much sympathy for the Jesuits, who are prisoners of sorts, but they're German Jesuits. They're stuck in Canada during the Second World War. I think it's the Second World War.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And in many ways, they're very kind to the Indian students. I mean, they have their problems, and certainly they play tricks back and forth on each other. But that one story about summer holidays in Spanish, where they all go off to the island and just sort of roam around, you know, there really is. It's just people on the island, you know, making do. And the Jesuits have their own way of doing things, and the Indian kids have their own way. Very powerful story. And it doesn't involve itself with making the Indians victims or victors in it. But you wind up seeing a very human side of native life that you don't see in many books. Just don't see it at all.
Actually, that's can be said about Medicine River, too.
I'll let you say that.
Yeah, but it's true, and I'm pretty sure you were aiming at that too.
Well, I wanted to make sure. I wasn't concerned about the white community in Medicine River. My focus really was on the native community, and so, you know, whatever kinds of mistakes the people make in Medicine River, I wanted to make sure that they were native mistakes that they made. So I didn't want to do what Kinsella does, you know, pit Indians against whites, because I think you begin to lose track of some of the really powerful things in contemporary Native life. And the other thing, too, is that you make it sound as though that's the way Natives spend their entire existence, is ranting and railing against non-Native whatever. And it just isn't true. There was a guy, I told this before, there was a guy at Victoria who got up and wanted to know why I didn't picture Indians realistically, you know, as drunks and down and outers and suicides and whatnot. And he was saying that, that 30% or so Indians, I forget what the statistic he gave me, 30% of Indians were like that. My response was, well, but they're the 70%, you know, what are we doing? Just, you know, sitting around waiting to get drunk or suicidal or whatever else. And the other thing that I like to point out in my talks that I give is that if things were that bad, if things were really as bad as non-native writers picture them, and some native writers too, if they were that bad, we'd be dead as a people. We wouldn't have lasted 500 years. So there's something that keeps us going, and the thing that keeps us going is that the situation isn't that bad. Now, as soon as you say that, people say, oh, well, don't you have this, don't you have that? And the answer is yeah, sure, we have that. We also have a certain tenacity and a strength within the culture that keeps us going. And I think that people like Slipperjack and Johnston, and I know I certainly am keen on that, I want to show that. That's what I want to look at. Now, 10 years from now, people are going to say, those people are soft. You know, they're not dealing with the real issues. This is sort of a different kind of romanticism, you know, some more kind of bubblegum. And okay, maybe it will be, depending on what the literature comes out with.
It could go the other way too.
Yeah, it could.
But the maturity comes when this basic issue that is always there, or the fight, is sort of set aside and say, okay, we clarified the issues, now let's go to down to the essentials, and that is human survival.
The other thing that's nice about Johnston and Slipperjack is that they don't prioritize their Indians.
No?
They don't start talking about who's a better Indian than whom. There's no pecking order between full bloods, half bloods, mixed. They're all there together. We don't even know, you know, if they're all full bloods or if, some mixed bloods.
And with Slipperjack, there's no telling. Is this a native community? Are they Indians? Are they white?
Not at all. That's right.
It's not an issue at all.
That's
they're
right.
People.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it just even in Medicine River, even though you know that Will is not a full blood,
mm-hmm.
his father's white, there really isn't a big deal made of that particularly, except at one point when the question of status comes up for the kids and for the mother. But it's just something that is so divisive, and to enshrine it in literature, I think, is just asking for problems.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, and it doesn't get you any place. It doesn't move the fiction along.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk about the kinds of oppressions that a white culture has had on natives, there's all sorts of other ways to do it which are much more powerful. I listen to poets. I think in some ways poets are the worst offenders, native poets, especially those who really get involved in polemical doggerel, where the poem itself is simply a complaining about the kind of oppression. And it's not that the oppression does not take place. It's not that kind of oppression is not true. The point is that if you're going to enshrine it in a poem, do it in such a way that it has an impact. And it has very little impact if you just throw it out there and say, here it is, I am an Indian, I don't like the way you've treated me, you've brutalized me, etc., etc., etc. After a while, it has no impact at all. People just turn their ears off, If you're a poet, that's not poetry, that's not creative writing. That's simply polemical sort of preaching. I think you have to get beyond that and figure out clever and marvelous and sparkling ways to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry is—it's that economy of language that has this marvelous effect. A very skilled thing, and I think it gets mistaken.
When you think of native writers, poets, there's some that you think of. Who get beyond this? Lament.
Yes.
That you would
lament is
a
very nice way. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I just say lament.
No. Lament's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the stereotype. The Indians lament.
Yeah. Yes. Mm. Yeah. That's right. The white man's lament. Indian maiden's lament.
Yeah.
Just before she kills herself.
Yeah. Indian burial ground.
Oh yes. Yes. Oh
well,
yes.
I mean, this sounds cynic, and I shouldn't be saying that, but I think I know which text and also which authors you're talking about, but there's some who sort of move beyond that, I think, and are there some that you would mention in particular?
Oh yeah, I think there are a number who move beyond that. Certainly people like Joy Harjo and Louise Erdrich,
mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite, Lucy Tapahanzo,
mm-hmm.
who is, Tapahanzo writes these great poems about Navajo cowboys,
mm-hmm.
and they are sparkling things, just sparkling. That kind of poetry, avoids that trap that that polemics can catch you up in. Who else? Let's see. Some of Jeanette Armstrong's poetry, very powerful stuff. And Jeanette comes to the edge of that.
Yes.
A lot
yes,
of times she comes right to the edge, but she very seldom falls over. She does sometimes, I think, but mm-hmm. but not often. Who else do I like as a poet a lot? Lance Henson, like a lot of Lance's pieces. And again, Lance ignores a lot of the conflict. His poetry is concerned with native people, with ceremonies, with ways of thinking, if you will.
Yes, and even where he sort of makes political statements, it's not a political statement that just raises the issue of race or ethnicity. If you think of the one about America, people living in cardboard boxes, carrying banners declaring their hunger.
Oh,
images
yes.
like that.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not a race issue, it's the poverty, or the one about Kent State where he says, yeah. God damn you, America. He's raising the Vietnam issue.
Yeah.
But it's, that's
and,
true.
And you've got Maurice Kenney, you
oh,
have
yes.
Peter Blue Cloud,
oh, yes.
Joseph Rorschach.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
okay,
just a lot. Yeah, Paula Gunn-Allen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people who have moved mm-hmm. beyond that. And once you do, it makes a huge difference. Because you, if you want to talk about a political or a moral issue, if you're a good poet, always the best way is to sneak up on it and scare the pants off. If you run down the street yelling and screaming at it, it's just going to step aside and let
prepared.
You keep on going. They get prepared, that's right. Yeah, the mask comes on.
Mm-hmm.
They say, oh yes, it's true, oh yes, it's true, oh yes, it's true. Goodbye, see you later.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And I think it's probably that bit of advice, I suppose we'd call it that, is good advice for any writer. You know, not to let the message,
mm-hmm.
if you have a message, if there is a message that you want to play mm-hmm. with, get out of hand, become
yeah.
the overriding reason for doing the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard sometimes, it's hard. When I came back from Victoria after that confrontation with that one guy out there, I sat down to write a short story. It was called A Seat in the Garden, which was about this little bench that the guy supposedly had built so that these Indians,
mm-hmm.
who he called winos and Lysol drinkers, could sit down and crush their cans. And so I had to say to myself, okay, I'm really angry with that guy. I'm really angry with that kind of racist stereotype that he's conjured up. And I want to do something about it. So I started writing. But what I started to write wasn't worth the publication because I was still upset.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally I got around to where I could see the humor in it and the irony. And once I could do that, then the short story just came like that. It was a good
mm-hmm.
short story.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's hard for people to get around that. And sometimes they use it as a blanket to wrap themselves in, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of providing them, well, this is a horrible thing to say, but I think for some native writers, and probably more for natives raised in urban areas, it's one of the things that they can wrap themselves up in, this sympathy, this abuse, that they think gives them an Indian identity. I mean, they're native,
mm-hmm.
they don't have the connections that they'd like to have, that many of us don't have. And so they wrap themselves up in this particular blanket. But it doesn't serve anything, I don't think. In the end, it does not serve literature very well, however you want to define it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it serves Indian people in general.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more taken with Ruby Slipperjack's description of an Indian community than I am with some other writers that we can think of, you know, that really bang away on the oppression.
Yeah.
And probably because much of it's positive. I'm tired of negative images of Indians, whether Indians develop them or whether non-Indians develop them. And I'm tired of romantic
mm-hmm.
images too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to see some very, very calm, very ordinary images. Indians doing ordinary things that, you know, sort of bring them, you know, we're all human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Although I suppose some people would like us to believe that Indians are supernatural human beings. That's not true. It's not true. Though I've got this short story in mind that I wrote, as a matter of fact, about, it's called Corporal Colin Sterling Saves Blossom, Alberta, and Most of the Rest of the World as Well. It's published in Whetstone. And it's about Indians in Alberta turning hard, becoming petrified with a sort of shiny covering over them, the spaceships coming down and picking them up.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that's conveyed is that Indians are from this other superior race, and they sort of got left on Earth for a while, and they've been waiting for these damn spaceships to come back down and pick them up. Matter of fact, one of the Indians is chanting, "What took you so long? What took you so long?" As they, and anyway, it's a nutso story about this one RCMP corporal who tries to save the Indians from the spaceships. And anyway, it's so sometimes I go off on.
Was that in the last Native issue?
No, it was in a middle Native issue. If you want, I'll send you a copy of it. Mm-hmm. I've got a copy. It's a silly story.
Mm-hmm.
But
if you say had to teach a course somewhere new on Native literature in general or Canadian, take your choice. Which books would you include?
Well, I'm more comfortable with fiction than I am with poetry or drama. So probably, I take Erdrich's Tracts, which is my favorite of hers. I would take, certainly, Anna Scott Mumbay's Housemaid of Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
Welsh's Winter in the Blood.
Mm-hmm.
Slipperjack's Honor of the Sun. Johnston's Indian School Days. Probably Silco's Ceremony. I've got some problems with Ceremony, but I think it's a book that...
What kind of problems?
It's the second half of the book that, for me, breaks down a little bit.
Where it sort of leaves our reality?
No.
Whatever whose reality?
No, that's not my problem. It just seems as though she pushes much too hard for... towards resolution and a climax in the second part. And the language itself, I think, is not as crisp, not as powerful in the second part of the book. It's got nothing to do with the flashbacks back and forth. I think those are good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it has to do with... I'm not sure what it has to do with. It sort of loses... something for me. Then it picks it up again at the very end when Teo is at the uranium mine and he looks
at
the rock.
Really,
that's
really
very powerful. Very powerful there. So it picks up again, and when Granny says, "I've heard these stories before, but only the names have changed," you know, that part of the ending is very powerful. There's a lull in there, and I suppose it's when he's looking for the spotted cattle, and you have that whole sequence with the mountain lion and the hunter changing back and forth, and say, who sort of comes and goes, is the mountain, is the woman, and all of that.
Yeah.
That I probably just don't know the book that well.
Yeah, and maybe one really would have to know more about Laguna and Navajo.
Could.
The Yellow Woman. I mean,
stories,
some research has been done into that, and maybe it makes more sense though. But I had the same feeling in that part of the novel because I simply didn't understand what she was talking about.
There seems to be a flat spot in there.
Although I really liked the book.
Yeah,
really loved it.
And I wouldn't teach a class without it, I don't think. Yeah. But then Gerald Visner, and it would be. Problematic which book I choose there. I could choose Griever, I could choose Darkness of St. Louis Bearhart, although I'd probably choose his autobiography, the new piece that's just been published. And I'd probably try to get something by Craig Key Street, Cherokee writer out of California now. And let's see, who
Michael
else?
Doris?
Possibly, although Michael's stuff and Louise's stuff is very close. The same sort of thing, and so if I used Louise, I might not use Michael, but I could. But I think I'd probably use Tracts. I'm very fond of Tracts. And let's see, what else is there? That's a pretty good slug of books, as a matter of fact. Who have I left out? Oh, there's a number of people I left
older
out.
Older ones, like Darcy McNichol, or.
Yeah, actually,
Morning Dove?
Yeah, I'd have to
if
use
you
those.
To have
yeah.
ones.
If I was teaching a year long class, certainly McNichol, Morning Dove, John Joseph Matthews, John Oskinson.
Yeah.
Oskinson.
Dallas Chief Eagle, did you ever read that Winter Count?
Two copies of it.
No, I only got a photocopy one, but I got it.
Do you know the
That's
interest?
That's a really interesting book.
It's an interesting book to read.
It's very contrived in a way.
Yeah.
Historically, it's interesting.
I'm not sure I'd use that, but I've got two first editions with two different publishers.
See.
I don't know how it happened. I was going to give one away.
No, there's something really, really
it's a weird,
fishy about the publication. I think he paid for it himself. I got it from a German student who was in the Lakotas, and she got the copy from him, I think. Or some of his relatives, because they said, we've got this book, it's sitting there, he paid for it to get it published, and it's not selling.
Yeah, well, so, they, one of the, I mean, there's no indication which is the first edition, mm-hmm. but I have two copies of it, and one has Naylor Company, I think it is, and the other one has another company in Colorado.
That's the one I've got in Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah, Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
Well, I've got one there and one in Texas.
Oh, that's interesting.
Same book. I don't know which
There's
one came first. There's a story behind that, yeah. So some of the early stuff, sure, and you can even use some of the short stories. Early short stories are published by Native writers.
Yeah, if you teach short stories, maybe we go through the whole range. We've covered the novels, the short stories, what collections
God, there's no. Well, there's Earth Power Coming, which is the best collection of short fiction by Native writers in the U.S. Mm-hmm. out. And I suppose All My Relations will be the anthology to use
for Canada.
Canadian writers.
How do you like The Man to Send Rain Clouds? I mean, that's 20 years old almost.
Yeah, well, the problem with The Man to Send Rain Clouds is that almost half of the stories are by Simon Ortiz and Leslie Silva.
Very selective one area.
Yeah, very selective one area. And mm-hmm. so it's an anthology only in the most general sense of the word. It really is the Silco and Ortiz show.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're both good writers, so it doesn't hurt the anthology at all. But many of the other pieces in that anthology are not, they don't compare very well to Ortiz and Silco. So, you know, certainly I'd use Earth Power Coming as a beginning. Mm-hmm. Although that doesn't include everybody. And then, you know...
What would you use for Canada? Well, you said your collection could be used. But there's... that's a problem I have. There's no anthology of Canadian Native writing so far.
And
Agnes Grant has been in the pipeline for at least a year.
Yeah.
With Pemmican on it. I don't see that coming out yet.
I haven't seen it.
I've seen a manuscript, a list of what is contained in there.
Yeah.
It could really be used, but I don't know.
And even my anthology is going to take a little bit of heat because I've got a couple of writers in there who are very marginally Native. But I wanted to include the whole range. From as you know, traditional as I could possibly get, Harry Robinson, I suppose, on the one end, all the way down to very marginal mm-hmm. Native writers who are still nonetheless writing about Native topics,
mm-hmm.
you know, who had made that commitment, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm going to have people who are not in the anthology who are going to complain that, you know, they should have been in rather than these other folks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a problematic anthology. And I think what will happen is you're going to have two or three other anthologies coming out. And I don't know if they're going to be better or worse than All My Relations, but it's going to get some pretty good competition right away. So you'll have a selection, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm, that's good, yeah.
You'll have a good selection of what you can use. Well, poetry, certainly the guy who's done the most in the States is Duane Nieto.
Mm-hmm.
Those two
and
volumes.
Harper's an anthology of 20th century.
Yeah, yeah. It's a major. Mm-hmm. It's a major anthology. I can't think of another one that comes close.
I always use Song from the Earth and Turtles Back by Joe Bruchak. For a textbook, I mean, the pricing and being a paperback,
that's true.
Very usable.
I keep forgetting
but
about that because I keep forgetting about it because it was a small press publication.
Yeah.
It's hard to get.
But you can get it straight from Greenfield Review Press.
If they have any more left.
They do. They reprint all the time.
Oh, do they?
Oh, yes.
Because
I've ordered it many times.
I was out of print once when I wanted to use that.
Oh, that's too bad. No, but actually Joe is very good about keeping on stock.
Well, you've got those two, certainly, mm-hmm. Needham and Bruchak. You know, easy. They've got nice collections. In Canada, you don't have anything.
No.
Nada.
There's the seventh generation, but that is just very few.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's a group of people who've known each other and sort of worked on this together. So it's not a sort of representative anthology for the whole of Canada.
Yeah, that I don't.
That is lacking.
Yeah. And something like Marilyn Bowring and David Day's Many Voices has so many non-natives in there. I mean, people just sort of snuck into it.
I've only seen that as a sort of bibliographical entry, but I've never seen the book.
Well, Cam Hubert's in there, who is Ann Cameron, who is not native. But there are a number of other people in there, too.
Is Cam Hubert Ann Cameron?
Yeah, Cam Hubert's Ann Cameron.
Didn't know about it. You see, when I first came to Regina in 87, I looked up the university bookstore to see what is it, what do they teach in Native Literature.
Daughters of Copperwoman.
Sure, and Cam Hubert, too.
Yeah.
So I then talked to my present boss, and I said, well, I really think this is weird. And so those are not on the list anymore, though. But,
But that anthology, one of the problems was it was supposed to be all natives, and it wasn't in the end. There were quite a few non-natives in there. It doesn't hurt the poetry or anything. It was just that if you buy it, the anthology for that, then you'll be disappointed if you're going to teach a course. So no, there is not one good anthology of native poetry for Canada. And I don't know who's going to do it because I'm not. I'm not that good of a... I write poetry, but I'm not that good of a critic on poetry to do it. Oh, well, God. You've got...
Maybe we stop there.
That's okay.
I mean,
well,
about this long list, because that'll be a long
list. Well, autobiography is, oddly enough, one of the major genres for Native writers.
Absolutely.
And partly, I think, it is because if there's one thing that non-Native readers love to read, it's how real Indians live.
Yeah.
They love to read about old-time Indians and how they manage things.
And even today.
It's a great draw.
Yeah.
And so I think that autobiography will continue. And much of it is not autobiography. It's biography. But it's no good. It's going to sell a lot easier. For instance, John Lame Deer publishes Lame Deer Secret of Visions. But Erdos is the one who's going to write that up.
Exactly.
Nyhart and Black Elk. You have all of these combinations that are seen as autobiography, and they're not truly autobiography. They're through that
as
other person, as told to,
Or they just run as autobiography and they're aren't. But in Canada, there's some that are mainly written by the person herself. I guess that Maria Campbell wrote her book herself.
Yeah.
At least that's what she told me. And again, there's some natives who say, oh, she didn't even write it. Okay.
I don't believe that. I've met Maria. I know her.
I don't believe that either.
Yeah.
No.
There's one book, though, that's quite interesting that I think is that I may use in my history courses next year, and that's Percy Lamble's book called... The Sun Came Down. Well, he's Blackfoot from the Browning area, so he's right on the line.
Percy
Lame Bull. I think it's Lame Bull. I hope I've got that right. Percy Lame Bull. Am I thinking of the character from Welsh's novel? Yeah, jeez. Percy Bullchild. There we go. I knew I was thinking of Welsh's
not
novel.
Not Buffalo Child Longlands.
No, not Buffalo Child Longlands. Sylvester Long.
Well, there are two, actually. There's one Buffalo Child in Germany who's married to a German, calls himself Buffalo Child, and has an Indian outfit, and dances in front of superstars to attract customers. I've never met him in person, but I know about him. Okay.
Yeah, it's Percy Bullchild, and it's a Harper's publication, and it's called The Sun Came Down.
And that's an autobiography?
Well, it's the history of the world as told by Blackfoot elders.
Oh, I see.
So it's a very interesting book.
Mm-hmm.
Very, sort of cuts across a number of genres.
Oh, yeah.
And that's gotten very little play. You know, I mean, it's there,
it's
available.
It's published already.
It's published already. It's been out for 3 years.
Well,
something like that. And it's in paperback now, so I can use it for my class. And it's sort of a history, and it's sort of a narrative history, and it deals with he starts at the beginning of the world,
mm-hmm.
you know, point one, works his way right on through.
That's where the oral history starts.
Yeah,
that's people who they are,
yeah,
where they come from.
Doesn't start with colonialism.
No.
Now it's infused with all sorts of metaphors that one thinks of as being more Christian than native, but nonetheless, you pick your way around those, mm-hmm. you know, and you sort of watch your footing, and it's a marvelous read. Marvelous read. So, you know, there's a place for that kind of a book in classes. The nice thing is this stuff is being taught in classes now.
Yeah.
You know, when I went through and you went through, there was nothing.
No, that's right.
Just stuff nothing at all. Zip.
Yeah. What also really impressed me was Earth Elder Stories when that came out.
Yeah.
Because to my knowledge, that's the first book of this kind entirely written, even introduced by Native people. And it's not an anthropologist or a missionary or an other as told to person editing it, but it's a Native going all the way, and that really impressed me. I might be using parts of this in class in Germany.
Sure.
And anything you would like to say to your German listeners?
Besides what's to eat?
No. Some people that I interviewed, so they thought it was a good idea that they could say something that they thought Europeans should be aware of when they approach Native literature, Native culture.
Well, I suppose the only thing that I'd say that I'd like, and that is that...
I just want endorsement.
Endorsement, right.
No, just go ahead, whatever you like.
No, I think the only thing that I'd say is, to watch out for the romanticism contained within the images of Indians, that it'll trip you up.
Sure.
It'll do a couple of things. One, the biggest thing is that it'll disappoint you.
Sure.
If you come, let's say, to America thinking that that we're long-haired, riding on ponies, or even doing any of that sort of...
It's even more. A lot of people in Germany now who are interested in natives are sort of in ecology,
mm-hmm.
and they're very strong in that.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
we get so much rhetoric from native people about Mother Earth, and I strongly believe in that.
Yeah.
But I also see native people not thinking twice about plastic or having their car run day in and day out and stuff that people are really concerned about.
Yeah.
And I think that's a drawback for a lot of Europeans coming over here and say, God.
Yeah, I don't think it's so much that Indians are environmentalists, in the way in which the word is used.